Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife, conversations with artists and activists about death and life. My name is Dave Marr. I'm a comedian. I live in Chicago. At the moment, I am in Cleveland. Going to see the solar eclipse from, I guess, the zone of full coverage or whatever it's called. I hope your eclipse was good. I hope you retained your sanity or went insane in the ways you wanted to. This week, I am talking to Nick Turner, who is a musician who goes by the name Tyresta. He is a therapist, and you get to hear in this episode how a therapist experienced the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was reaching out for therapy. So I'm excited to present that perspective. He's also a fan of the show, and that warms my heart. I was very grateful to talk to him. You can listen to the new Tyresta album called Small Hours, came out at the end of 2023. You can also pre-order the new Montgomery and Turner album, Sound Is Our Sustenance. It's the duo of Nick and JV Montgomery. That's coming out at the end of April. Both those links to those band camps are in the show notes. You can also book therapy with Nick if you want to do that at the link in the show notes. And if you want a little bit of background to this episode, not necessary, but the Jeffrey Cantu Ledesma episode from a couple of weeks back, it does get referenced at least once in this episode. You know, we talk about Zen, and that might be a nice compliment to this episode. You can also donate to Chicago Abortion Fund to provide healthcare to folks who need it. And also, I produce This Is Your Afterlife without ads or corporations. So if you believe in this show, I would love for you to become a patron. You could pay me $5 or $15 a month to continue making the show. And you can do that at patreon.com/Dave Marr. When you do, you immediately get access to an extended version of this conversation, plus a bunch of other cool bonus audio content. Thank you to Pigeon Level patrons, G, Barry Fontenot, Shubha Singh, Debo, Fred Fidawa, and Katie Llewellyn. And that's it. I hope you have a good week, and I'll talk to you on the other side of the episode. Here's Nick Turner. And so you know that I was in a coma for a month and eulogized on Facebook and all that stuff. And so you understand that when I ask people on the show, what's your coma? What I'm asking is about a moment of transformation where before you're one version of yourself and after you're another. And we've identified the birth of Tyresta, your solo music career. But there you've also, you know, already, like, I could probably go back and mention and identify, if I'm dog-earing the book, like 8 different comas in this like 5 minutes we've been talking.
Yeah.
But what one are you thinking about at the moment? Like, what is the before and after inflection point that's like most occupying your mind and your life and your thoughts right now?
Currently, yeah, it's an interesting question. Because I feel like there were two albums that I made particularly. Well, there was a lot of albums I made like from 2016 through 2020, because I was just like, even 2021, just like constantly recording.
Yeah, there's like 5 records on your Bandcamp from like March to June of 2020.
Yeah, it was just like a lot piled up.
Yeah.
Because I just had a lot of material that I was just like constantly recording. My initial instrument was guitar, and I've like now come back to it. I've moved away from synths. I still have some, but like during that period, I like got into modular synthesis and was just like teaching myself how to do it. And so I was just like constantly recording and exploring. And so that was a lot of it. It was just like, I was recording everything while trying to learn it, because it's a kind of a complicated thing. And it was a lot of fun, but it also felt really cathartic. And so a lot of that was like working through my thoughts about and feelings about my mom's illness and her eventual passing. And since, I think a lot of the fuel has just been what's going on in the world, really. I mean, I think currently where my headspace is at and the type of music I'm making, which is like heavier and darker and is just more about like the situation in Gaza and just like more kind of society and culture in general, and the things I'm like afraid of for the future of the human race. I know that's a broad answer, but that's like really
No.
what's
Well, was
I'm
there, have you always been clued in to those things? Or maybe there's an inflection point where your gaze turned toward that stuff. 'Cause yeah, the fallout from October 7th and all these different things is like, yeah, hard to, and probably not necessarily too many people's before, well, maybe it is people's before and after sort of coma moment, but like it sounds like what we're talking about now are the effects of some coma that turned your eyes toward these things.
It definitely didn't start with what's happening currently. I mean, I think it started like during the first initial, we'll say the initial years, because sometimes we have this pattern of like during the pandemic as if
Right.
it's over, but like the initial years of the pandemic, like my as a therapist, that first like. My mom passed away like right before the lockdown. So like, in February 2020, she passed away, and then we like sort of locked the world locked down. And then
Right.
my inbox got flooded with clients because everyone was like distressed, like what's happening? And so I was like trying to mourn, and then also like taking on all these clients, and just what really sort of became very even more apparent. I was aware of this stuff before and all that, but like during those initial years of the pandemic. And like a lot of people, like, with George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and just like everything and the way and the racism and everything that was coming out with Trump being president, like a lot of that stuff just like it was on my mind before and I was aware of it before and I was somewhat engaged with it before, but like I feel like I passed a threshold at that point where it's like it's just on my mind daily, and I'm thinking more about it, and I'm like trying to be more of even more of a like just thoughtful human being to like try to decrease suffering and through whatever means possible, and being able to not stay silent, because before I would be like worried about saying something, or I'd be it'd just be like I don't want to deal with this. So I don't know if that directly answers your question, but it does feel like there was this pivot point over the past 4 years that I'm a very changed person, and I think in a good way.
A good way, but a good way maybe the way I because I relate, and the way I feel it's a good way is a good way of like more alignment with like core values, but not an easy way, a very heavy way, you know?
Which is like again, like reflected in some of the music I'm making now, why I think I've gravitated back towards the guitar, why I'm gravitating more towards heavier music or more free music where there's like less limitations and there's just more catharsis, in a different way, in a less kind of composed, less planned way.
Okay, the synthesizer stuff is more composed.
Yeah, for me, I mean, like it's more kind of there was like I would like sort of program patches and work with sequencers and just like have everything planned out,
Okay.
much less im well, I don't know if that's true, but yeah, I mean, like I think much less expressive. It was expressive in a different way, but when you're working with modular synths, you could like set up patches that play themselves, and you're
Right.
thinking of the sounds and the timbres and like how to get things to talk to one another. But some of that stuff is just the machine. And happy accidents
Right.
versus like if I have a guitar in my hands or I'm not a keyboardist, but I can figure my way around it. For me, it just feels much more connected to the instrument in a much more direct line for expression.
So, a side note here, for someone who's trying to get into, who's maybe coming from a world of, let's say, even pop punk, let's say, something as the Mogwai is the most I would bet that most of the listeners of my podcast have not heard the name Mogwai. So like so someone like that, how do you tell them, almost like modern art, like someone who's like, my kid could paint that, you know, or like with synthesizers, like how Can anyone tell who the good people are? What the good version of it is? Like, what is, what signifies or communicates like quality in that music to you?
I mean, this is like part of my own transformation of just like learning to hear music in everything and learning how to just like, if something speaks to you, then it's good. Because for me, for so long, I was like trapped in this idea of like, that's good, this is bad, and it would limit my creativity. And so it's been very freeing to just like improvise with people who are way better than I am or way more experienced musicians than I am, and just having them say, no, what you're doing is what you're doing, and we're going to play it and go with it and say yes to it. So I guess to answer your question, and I'm trying to evade the answer here, It's like, I think whatever speaks to you is good. And so like, for some, you know, like in that music particularly, there were some artists that like, I was like, oh, interesting. And it kind of caught my ear and inspired me and kind of led me on that journey.
Well, who are those?
Like Caitlin Aurelia Smith and Suzanne Ciani, they released a collaborative album called Sunergy. And people like Tim Hecker, I would say like, particularly that was where the headspace I was in when I got into modular synthesis and when I like dove into that music, but particularly that Sunergy record, it was just like, I have some of the, like what's the Buchla synthesizers and that record they used exclusively Buchla synths. And I was like, I love those sounds. Like, okay, how can I, you know, head in that direction?
Right. Totally. But it's like, I love the sound of a Fender Rhodes piano. Mm-hmm. It's like the most soothing sound to me. So someone could just play like looped, you know, one note every 15 minutes on a Fender Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
And convince me that they're good. Like, it would take me a while to figure out, like, what? Wait a second. They're doing this. I've been listening to the same thing for 45 minutes or whatever.
And that's really difficult to do, right? To make minimal music where you're just like really focused. And like, you know, I think people sort of, like you said, they're like, oh, my kid can paint that.
Right.
To have that much patience and to play like one chord and really listen, or one note and really feel that and give it the space it needs.
But we all know examples of things like that, right? Where it's like, there's the master. It's almost like a sort of Buddhist koan almost of like the master who plays the one note, and all of his decades of experience and meditating have gone into that, versus like the petulant 20-year-old who just cheekily presses one note and kind of like smirks while doing it, and we all hear it differently. You know what I mean? Like, how do you account for that?
Yeah. I mean, like, I just think for me, if there's emotion in it, if there's authenticity in it, I'll respond to it, and I'll like want to, like, I'll be curious and I'll want to, like, you know, listen and kind of lean in. But I think, I don't know, there's just when I hear a piece of music or when I see a performance like that, and I know like this person's performing in a way that isn't authentic to me, that I can't connect with it. But I've had that response to things that other people really connect with. So that's why I just like, I'm trying as I get older and as I try to practice Zen, like letting go of that judgment and being able to just like let people have their experience and not be like, I know what's good and that's bad.
You said something interesting about like the feeling attached to it and the reason for you making this music had to do with these feelings and these things to express. And one of the albums of yours that I listened to was the, God, what was it? It was in something. It was the real, I was like, oh, This is your afterlife album. The like religious transformation from Catholic to atheist and atheist to what's that name of that?
Was it In Raptures?
In Raptures. That's what it was. Yeah. And so I'm like, what does it mean to you to translate feeling or to make instrumental music about something?
Yeah. So I usually because I very rarely will sit down and think, like, at least at this point in a lot of these albums that I was making, like, I'm going to write an album about this.
Right.
I'll just sort of sit down. At the time when I wrote In Raptures, I had more of the modular synths, but also like a digital Mellotron and guitar stuff of just like start playing and looping and coming up with something and following notes and sounds that like, oh yeah, I'm connecting with this. Let me follow this train of thought or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the narrative starts to kind of come together as I start to re-listen to the songs, as I start to overdub or layer. It's like, oh, okay, I think this is what this is about. And song titles will come or narratives will come as I listen back to it. And it's sort of a guess in a lot of ways. Like, I think this is what I was trying to say.
Okay. So at what point, like, is it simply, am I trying to dig too deep on an ineffable process to ask at what point does it reveal to you as being about something to go, oh, how do you know? Or is it just like, oh, these sounds together remind me of blank. And mm-hmm. I can't explain why they just do. And I don't want to necessarily examine why too much.
I think for me, like when I'm making an album, I'll be in a certain headspace or like inspiration will strike and then I'll get a group of songs together. And typically when I feel like, okay, this is it, or I feel like largely this is going to be the group of songs and maybe I'll eliminate one or two, but I'll listen to it quite a bit. And as I'm listening, I'll write down song titles. I'll write down colors, pictures, memories that like come up. And then it tends to be this way. That's, I think, the magic of it. Like you're channeling something, and I'll be able to kind of build a narrative around it because it feels right or it feels true.
Okay.
Great. I don't know if that answers your question.
It totally does. I think I enjoy like trying to like quantify these things as mm-hmm. the intellectual exercise of like, what if we could quantify these processes? But I, you know, understand and embrace their mystery for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's part of the fun.
It's fascinating to hear about a flood of clients coming in March of 2020. Yeah. I feel like that is a perspective on the pandemic and the lockdowns that I have not heard.
Yeah.
What was that like? Because the thing you're describing and the thing we were kind of pointing at earlier of like getting turned on to and the transformation is like, you have a very particular view on the thing people refer to when they like type in the words waves hands around all this, you know what I mean? Like an email where it's like someone being like, hope you're doing as well as you can. It's like during these unprecedented times, you have a view into the unprecedented times. And I'm curious what are the stories from that time when you were flooded with new clients as a therapist? What are the stories that exist that you don't think like got told about that time? Like, what are the things that you observed that you feel like have gotten kind of flattened in the way we remember that?
I mean, I think what became even more apparent was that we're so we don't have enough space to feel things, and we don't have enough space to deal with ourselves. And when that space, we were forced to reckon with ourselves and forced to just like slow down and not leave the house and sit with our feelings. It just highlighted how much as a society we are avoidant and not taught, right? How to slow down, how to create space, how to, have that connection with ourselves and even other people, right? Because people were housing, like staying in place, and with their partners or other family members, and like weren't just, couldn't be as distracted as they usually are with work and everything else. So I don't know if this gets at what you were asking at, but that's a lot of what I was seeing was like people having to face their trauma history, people's having to face their addictions because their drinking increased significantly with the lockdowns or drug use or whatever it was. Like it was just like a lot of people's neglect catching up to them.
Right.
And now that we've kind of seemingly ramped up again, I don't know if we've learned that lesson of like creating space and taking care of ourselves in the ways we need.
I don't think we have at all.
Yeah.
I truly hate to say it, 'cause it felt like there were moments when maybe we could. But it sure feels like as soon as people were able to just pretend like everything was fine again, they took that opportunity.
Absolutely. So that, but that's a lot of, I mean, I'm seeing that obviously as a therapist, you see people who are dealing with stuff, but I think a lot of people were forced to, and that's caused this like thing, like, oh, I'm feeling things, I'm thinking about things, I'm experiencing things that I don't know what to do with, and not just about what was happening currently. It wasn't just about
Yeah,
COVID, right? Like it
right.
was about a lot of other things.
Were you able to accept all the new client requests you got, or were there certain like canned responses or sort of screening questions that you would like, the way that like certain artists will get people at like young, will get young versions of themselves asking like, how do you make it? And they're like, this is the thing I tell everyone, almost as if they have like a doc where they can like copy and paste their probably very good, but like at a certain point, canned advice. Did you have versions of that for various issues?
No, I mean, like I took on as many as I could, and I mean, it resulted in burnout, and that's a whole nother kind of story that I'm like finally recovered from. But like, it was, yeah, it wasn't, 2021 was like a bad year, for me personally. I took on as many people as I could. I took on too many people. And then the ones I couldn't take care or take on, I would at least try to link them with other therapists. So I'd apologize and try to be like, hey, like you can check out these people. If they don't have room, touch base with me again. I'll keep giving suggestions. So I tried to be helpful to even those I couldn't take on, and people appreciated that.
It wasn't just like, hey, if you're not able to find anybody, try to get 8 hours of sleep, drink a bunch of
No.
water.
No. Yeah.
So it sounds like the in 2020, you also did not have all the coping mechanisms that you needed in place.
No, I mean, like my whole life. I think, like, I grew up in a loving family, but with two anxious parents, and and who had anxious parents before them, and before them, and before them, and so self-care wasn't modeled. What was modeled was like work a bunch, like distract yourselves, like, and so like going into grad school and being like, I'm gonna be, yeah, I got this. I'm the therapist. I'm good. And then like the pandemic forced me to really reckon with, oh, I haven't been taking care of myself for years in the ways I needed. And it's like forced me to sort of say, no, I'm not infallible, and I am subject to burnout and depression and anxiety and insomnia, just like everybody else.
So you, but you didn't acknowledge that early on, and that is, it
No.
sounds like what led to the burnout.
Yeah, because I just like, my mom had just passed away. I mean, I didn't, I've been doing okay with the mourning and grieving and all that, but like it's an intense experience. And then like I'm back seeing clients 5 days later, 4 days later, and then the lockdowns happen, and we went from there. But like, yeah, like taking on so many clients where I'm seeing sometimes seven people in a day for therapy is just like no one should be doing that. But I just like I was letting my own like sort of feeling like, well, the world is, suffering right now, so let me do what I can to relieve that, but I like at the expense of my own mental health.
You said recovered from burnout, which I'm very pleased and like impressed to hear. I feel like when I hear people talk about burnout, it's mostly like it's a very burnout response of like, yeah, that's a thing that I probably have, but I'll take care of it at some point situation. But it sounds like you actively kind of dealt with it. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, again, I want to recognize I'm in a pretty privileged position because like right before like a year or so before for COVID, I like had transitioned into private practice, and I was working for a group practice, and now I just have a solo practice. I'm on my own, but the group practice was with like people from the Buddhist Sangha that I sit with, and so they were all kind of people I had known for a long time, so they were super supportive and weren't pressuring me to take on more clients than I needed. That was like on me. But all that to say, like I'm in charge. I can like sort of pull back on my caseload. I can set my own hours. Like I have the ability with my job to like better my situation. I can pull back. I can take the time I need. I can schedule clients, every other hour, so I have an hour to play music or meditate or go for a walk along the lake. Like a lot of people don't have that position, right? They're just in a job that they have to work and they're kind of trapped, so they can't just be like, well, let me adjust my schedule so I can recover from burnout. Like,
Totally.
that's
Well,
part of our
you've
problem.
acknowledged your privilege. Now tell me how you did it with the privilege. What did you use this privilege to do?
2021, I went through a full year of insomnia. I was sleeping like maybe 3 hours a night, and it was like 4 hours a night sometimes. It was just like, yeah, I could get through my client sessions, but like I was useless otherwise. And it was just, I was not in a good place. It was like the most kind of anxious and depressed I've ever been. And so through finally finding a therapist, because it's hard to find a therapist as a therapist to work with, because like I'm like, I know what you're doing. Like,
Okay, sure.
so finally like finding a therapist, getting my sleep back under control, as my clients were doing better and needing to meet less often and some kind of moving on and finishing therapy, not taking on new cases, so that like I could get my caseload back to a place where, I could see, because really my sweet spot I think is like 20 people a week. If I get towards 30 people a week, it's like, yeah, too much, and then I start getting insomnia again and it just
Yeah.
starts up. So decreasing kind of people I'm seeing, but also, exercise. I live in Rogers Park in Chicago, so I live right by the lake, so I like have my walk that I do along the lake,
Okay.
which is really nice. And but yeah, meditating, playing music, like spending time with my wife and my dog, like just doing stuff that I wasn't doing when I was just working all the time and doing case. And I teach as well, so like also teaching during the pandemic and teaching social workers who like are going to grad school to like be in person and work with clients who now have to like do stuff online. So that was a lot as well. So like in like getting my teaching workload down to like a more manageable size as well. So just like making those adjustments helped a lot.
So when you had those adjustments, what were the signs that you were feeling less burned out? Was it like is burnout like depression? Is it like mania? Is it like anxiety? Like is there another sort of psychological phenomenon you can compare it to in terms of the onset? How aware you are of the onset, you know what I mean?
I mean, for me, it turns into depression and anxiousness, just like tension in my body, like increased. I already have social anxiety, but like through the roof. It's like 10 times worse when I'm burned out. But feeling that like lack of like, because doing therapy, just paying attention to people and being engaged in their experience emotionally, there's just like a bit more distance there, and it's harder to do that. And I was able to, and I don't think it affected my work too bad, but like the amount of energy it required to do it was far more than like now when I'm much in a much more healthier place. So by the end of the day, as an introvert, like I was fried because I'd like been talking for so long. But then I couldn't sleep because I was like just then processing the day. I'd heard so much stuff and taken on so many feelings during the day. So yeah, so I don't know. Yeah, that's really my experience of it. And just like being on edge all the time, being kind of just like quick to just like, snap and like be kind of crabby and like less like the person I wanted to be, like, which is like curious and open and loving.
So it's a gradual thing where you're noticing, you're just slowly noticing increased energy and ability to be present in those
Yeah, and
moments.
joy and like creativity and like
Right.
moments of happiness. Like they aren't like any feeling, right? Those are like, but it's just temporary, but it's like more of a range of feeling rather than just being kind of stuck in this headspace, which is like life is suffering and life is awful
Oof,
and
yeah.
like there's not much balance there.
Is that, does that any of that have to do with routine? Like how much structure do you need to support those things? Because I know of people, I wouldn't say I'm like this far into this side of the spectrum, but I probably do lean a little more toward the side of the spectrum that needs a little bit more structure. Like I resist it. I don't ever really want it, but when I do have some structure in place, I always notice that things feel better, but are you just kind of self-modulating and noticing like, oh, I need a little bit more of this or that? Or are you like, I know that I need X number of hours of sleep a night. I need to make sure I get this many walks in or anything like that. Like how rigid or rigorous is it?
I mean, I try to be at least a little flexible with it because, like, as someone that likes to see live music, like, sometimes there's shows on Thursday night that I want to go to, and but if I have to be picky, right? Because if I'm up late on a Thursday night and I don't get as much sleep, then I'm not going to be as sharp the next day, right? Like, that's just like anybody, and I need to be sharp for my 9 a.m. clients that I'm seeing on Friday morning. So I think I try to be fairly structured around my like evenings during the week, particularly, so I can get enough sleep and function. Because I can easily, there's been periods where I like kind of burn the candle at both ends, and then the insomnia starts to creep in again. And so then I know I'm like, okay, I know what this is, so let me pull
So what are
back.
those structures around sleep?
Shutting off TV or like YouTube, any kind of visual media, like at a certain time each night. Like making sure I'm not like texting people until 10 p.m. when I'm trying to go to bed, like really trying to have some boundaries with my phone and my computer. And like just like normal kind of bedtime routine stuff, but then like either reading or listening to like an audiobook, like nightly is crucial for me because that kind of helps me relax and come like my nervous system calm down. And it provides the kind of context for being able to just like fall asleep and sleep through the night.
So you're a Zen guy.
Yeah. I mean, I have a complicated relationship with religion given my like, but yes, like I
Well, what
sit
is it? Tell
with
me this
a
complicated relationship with religion.
Well, I mean, like I didn't grow up in a like a strict religious household. We were Catholic. We went to church on Sundays. I went through kind of catechism and like, did all the sacraments up until confirmation. But then like at 18, 19, that's when I was just like, I don't, when I, there was this moment where I was like a couple moments where I was like praying and I was like, just had this thought, like, I don't know if anyone's listening or I don't think anyone's listening. And it just kind of this light bulb went off, which at that point in my 20s, I swung too far the other direction because I was like this judgy atheist who like looked down on people. But then like that resulted in its own form of disconnection with people. I was like judgmental. I was getting in arguments. I was like sort of had this like attitude. And then in grad school, when I was like stressed out and like met one of my best friends who's a Buddhist, he was like, I maybe try meditating or maybe try like, learning a little bit about Zen. And
And it didn't feel evangelical?
no, I mean, I trusted him. We connected over music and we were kind of like had become really good friends. And I'd always been curious because I started learning a therapy that was like mindfulness based, and it was a sort of a secular mindfulness.
Wait, is it, what's the name of, is it, what is, does it have a specific name? This
Acceptance
therapy?
and commitment therapy.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So, and I was like, I'm curious about this because I think it borrows a lot from Zen Buddhism, which it does.
Right.
And so I was like, let me be curious about this. And as I started learning about Zen and practicing Zen, I was like, it was such a conflict for me because I was like, I'm an atheist. What am I doing here? And but I can't like argue with any of it. Like it all makes sense, and it's an amazing and beautiful life philosophy, and I've benefited tremendously from practicing. It just I have a hang up, I guess, about like sort of saying I'm this or I'm
Sure,
that.
of course.
But
What were
yeah,
the
I mean, like,
things that initially resonated? Like, was it, what did you start with? Was it just meditating? Were there lectures or I forget. I don't know if they're called Dharma talks in that tradition or whatever, but
reading like books by like Thich Nhat Hanh and like listening to some of his lectures and meditating, and then just like starting to kind of, I attended a couple meetings with my friend Hang's kind of sangha, and just like, the learning about like how to work with the mind as it is, right? Because so much of like what's out there psychology wise, pop psychology wise, teaches us just things that don't work and things that actually make things worse. And so to like change my relationship with my mind was such a like a powerful experience. And so it like sort of like it just really spoke to me. And that was like the initial thing that really hooked me, I think.
first of all, what's a sangha?
It's like a Zen community.
Okay.
So it's like a group of people you meditate with. There's typically a teacher. There's typically people with
Sure.
roles within the sangha.
That's what I figured, but I didn't want to like, yeah. Then, what are examples of the way the mind actually works?
So, there is no centralized location of self. The self is just this thing that we're kind of that's trained into us through kind of language processes and through the way we're asked questions when we're little. But we can't like open up someone's head and say, "Oh, there you are," right?
Sure.
And so we're taught that we have this fixed sense of self. This is who we are, and we can call self mind, right? Like this kind of idea. And we're told, "Oh, you just need to control your thoughts, or you need to control how you're feeling, or just be happy." And that's not the mind, right? The mind is a problem-solving machine. The mind is this thing that never really shuts up and kind of is a product of our history. And so if we can learn how to accept that, right? If we can learn to acknowledge that this, I have the mind I have, and I am not my mind, you develop a larger, a more expansive, more flexible, fluid sense of who you are, which, you don't waste time trying to like argue with your mind or trying to get rid of those thoughts or rid of those feelings. They're just things we have. They're things we contain, but we're not any one of those things. I don't know if that
Yeah.
makes sense,
No, it does. It definitely does.
but we're not taught that. We're taught like this is who you are, and those thoughts are bad, those feelings are bad. Don't have those things. If you have those things, that means something's wrong.
I mean, I want to ask you what you hope happens when you die, but also if these teachings and things you've learned in your Zen practice have any influence on
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I've listened before, so I was trying to was thinking of like how I would
that.
answer this
When
question.
is the question coming?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And if I hadn't been sitting and studying Zen when my mom got diagnosed and like over the course of her illness, like I would have been far more distressed and far more suffered far more if I hadn't like because like you know, there's teachings about impermanence and like non-attachment and being able to accept that all things are impermanent, right? Like, and I like Jeffrey's episode, the end with the five or six, five remembrances that he read, like,
Right.
that's like, yeah, I mean, that was, those are key. That's a key lesson for me. And one I practice with. So I was like really happy when he read that. Cause it sort of just acknowledges, right, that like, we're of the nature to grow old and sick and die, and everything around us is as well. And so we just have to appreciate those things while they're here. And so, and right, also with kind of death and dying, I guess I could, if you want me to answer the question.
I do want you to answer. What do you hope happens when you die, Nick Turner?
I mean, I have two answers, right? And both are right. Kind of, the one answer is sort of like related to my upbringing as like, you know, a Catholic. Like, the, I would love to be able to see my grandpa and my mom and my grand, like just relatives, pets, you know. But I think my version of that heaven would be like, if we could just shed all the baggage that prevented us from connecting on a deeper level, like letting go of competition and capitalism and ego, and be able to just like, be, you know, be that love, right? And just like, yeah, sort of connect on that way where we can just shed that crap and be rid of it.
That is a really interesting aspect of meeting your loved ones, because no one really mentions like the idea of like previous conflict with the loved ones. It's like, it's always like, oh, I want to see the people who are beloved to me. And then it's like, well, then at what point do you start having the same fights you used to have as well?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I love my mom, but there were parts of her personality and the parts of the way she was that drove me wild. So like, I think like, you know, that was part of my mourning process too, of just being able to, I miss these things and I love her deeply. And there's a bit of relief in that as well. So being able to, like, if we were to see those people again or reunite with those people, like, be able to really connect on a deeper level than we were when they were alive, that would be like my idealized version of what heaven would be. But just people in general, it'd be so much better to just like connect and be loving and compassionate and embrace those things. But like, what I think actually happens, and what I it, like, through kind of the Zen lens of being able to return to the source, right? Like being able to sort of return to that universal sense of consciousness, to the universe, to that universal sense of being, where it's that emptiness, where we're all part of this thing. And there's nothing separate.
And does that, I mean, how much do your feelings align with accepting that sort of universal consciousness?
Yeah, that's the tricky part. Because like, I think, yeah, intellectually it sounds great, and like, I get it, and I really like, I think it's beautiful. And,
but are you afraid to die? Like, are you afraid?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's just, as someone who's experienced anxiety for much of my life, I think it's just kind of built into there. And there's those moments where it's like, you have those existential moments where it's just like, shit, I'm gonna die someday. Yeah. You know.
Right.
And like, I'm able to like, oh, you know, create space for those feelings and create space for those thoughts, and like, you know, not try to avoid them.
I mean, coming from an evangelical background, I understand the stakes of death, you know, in that world. Was there a particularly fire and brimstone element to your Catholicism, or was it the more, I associate it with a more like tempered sort of, we go to be with people, we have the fish fries, we do the things. Was it more like that?
Yeah. Okay. No, it wasn't fire and brimstone,
but you were praying regularly. It's by yourself.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, we went to CCD, or, you know, Catholic Ed, and would go to, like, you know, and it was in our house, but it was like, my parents weren't particularly religious. And like, as time went on and we got busier and into high school and stuff, we went to church less and less often. So it wasn't like, there wasn't a ton of pressure. There were some though. And especially like, as I got into my 20s, I'm like, I'm not a Catholic anymore. My mom's like, oh, what if we all go to heaven and you're not there? Like, there was some of that stuff. But nothing, it wasn't like, I can't say that it was like, you know, fire and brimstone, and I was punished for
Because that specific example you give, the example I have from my family is not, what if we all go to heaven and you're not there? It is not an absence of heaven. It is an, I don't want you to go to hell. It's like, right. It's a subtle shade of difference, but it's very important nonetheless.
Yeah, there wasn't even much I knew what hell was, and there was but there wasn't much talk of that. It was more just like, be a good person and we'll all like get reunited in heaven.
Totally.
Yeah.
If the afterlife included, let's say, a room where you could go and pop in and out of whenever you wanted, however many times you wanted, and it contained one memory of yours that you could relive particularly vividly, what would that memory be?
I forgot to think about this question.
Good, I gotcha. Dead to rights.
This is the one I forgot about. I don't know. I'm far more attracted to the idea of like being present for whatever happens, like in that moment. Like if I get to see, if that can happen, then I can definitely see my relatives that I.
Sure.
I don't know. This is like cheesy, but I guess like my mom loved Christmas, and she just like made Christmas very special as like a time where we could just like Christmas morning. This is like, yeah, cheesy and stock, but like that feeling of feeling connected as a family unit, and like sort of seeing how excited my mom, like, cause my mom was like, oh, mom, that was like her thing. She worked a job to put food on the table, but like she wanted to be a mom. And so being in one of those mornings where we were just like connected and present and very kind of loving towards each other. I think that was just like, that's such a powerful experience. And every year when like Christmas comes and it's like, as an adult, it's like not as magical anymore. Yeah, like the people, it's just such a heavy time of year. But also like, it's also beautiful in a lot of ways, but like, I don't know, that's the one that comes to mind because it's one that I like kind of think about every so often, but particularly.
Is there a particular Christmas that you think about?
No, I mean, I think when I was young enough where it was still before I became like an jaded adult.
Yeah. And before the atheism set in.
Yeah, more complicated feelings about religion and Christmas and consumerism. But I think like, you know, when I was like, you know, before the age of 10, before when things were still like, you know, I was a little more innocent and a little more just could like, just feel that magic and that innocence. Cause I think that, yeah, I guess in general, like I've talked about this a lot with people recently, just that trying as adults to sort of keep that sense of wonder and magic and kind of how therapeutic that can be and how hard it is to maintain it and get there.
Are there things that you seek out that you're like, well, every time I have an ice cream sandwich, it happens again or something like that?
Yeah, I think watching certain movies, I think does that for me. I think around like Christmas stuff, like my family, like watching Home Alone.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Cause that's like there's just this funny memory of me, like as a crabby, I don't know, 7-year old, whatever. I don't know how old I was when it came out. I was like, I don't want to see that, mom. You want me to see that. But then we went and saw it. And I like, it's one of my favorite movies. And we like watched it every year on Christmas.
Yeah.
Time.
Yeah. So totally.
I think it brings that sense of like playfulness and like innocence that I had as a kid. It kind of, you know, awakens that a bit. Which, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty, it's something that I think is important because it just gets kind of like life happens and that kind of just gets punished out of us.
Yeah.
But it's like, so I think therapeutic and helpful.
Do you have siblings?
Yeah. I have a younger sister.
Okay. So would it be one of the Christmases where she is there?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. And I think she would probably, I don't know. Yeah, it would be interesting to ask her this question, but I think she would probably say something similar because I think it's just, you know, like, yeah, I think so, because it just, we felt all kind of connected and we were in a good mood and there weren't kind of like any worries at that point. It was more just like, you know,
So if we're
being
not
together.
connecting it to a specific Christmas, we've got watching Home Alone. What other specific aspect, rituals are attached? Like, what were her fortés when it came to Christmas? Are there meals? Are there specific gifts you remember? Was there an advent calendar? What were her things?
Yeah, so we're like in a, like my mom's Sicilian, my dad's mostly Italian, and so we would make, and we still do, this is like a big kind of yearly
Dishes.
thing we do. No, cookies. We make like these Italian, like lemon cookies, chocolate cookies, these very specific ones to our family that like it's
Oh,
kind of this recipe that's been done for years.
amazing. That's some better than the fishes.
And we make ravioli as well. So like pasta,
Yo, wow. On
particular type of
Christmas
like,
Eve or
no, we tend to get together the week before. So we'll like make, you know, we'll take turn between my aunt and my cousins and us. We take, you know, certain jobs or certain tasks. We make certain cookies or they make certain pastas. Then we eat it either on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve. But exchange kind of the cookies and so that's like, and we still do that. I mean, that's something we, it's like non-negotiable.
What's your thing? Are you a cookies maker or a ravioli maker?
It switches by the year, so we'll switch between my
Okay.
aunt and
Oh.
cousins making the pasta and some cookies with us making a lot of cookies. So this year we're back on pasta duty.
Okay, nice. What other, do you remember specific, like were there marquee presents you got?
I think I was like the ones I got mo like I'm notoriously known in my family for being kind of stoic and like I don't like it super expressive. So the one that like my would always my mom would bring up be like that was the benchmark for like, oh, you got more ex it was the original Nintendo. Like that was like I like totally got up and started dancing with the box. That was just like really expressive. And every gift after that point was gauged. I'm like, is that a Nintendo level excitement from Nick? And because I got so much crap over the years for like, do you like the gift? Are you excited?
Right. Do you remember opening the Nintendo and doing that, or just people telling you that?
No, I remember like seeing it and like there's just a brief flash of me getting super excited and
Right. Well, so now would you, when you're talking about the importance of joy and like recapturing it, is that feeling joy or is that something else? I mean, I remember times as a kid performing that excitement sometimes. You know you're supposed to be, or people want you to, or you, it's a way to get attention to perform the excitement. I mean, yeah, so was the Nintendo joy or was it something else?
I think it was excitement. I don't know, like it was joyful. Yeah, like because it was like it's just not my natural response to like just be that expressive when I'm getting gifts. That wasn't performative. In a lot of ways, like some, like I guess maybe sometimes because like people were giving me crap, I would like, yes, I really like it because they would try to get it out of me. But yeah, no, that was like a moment of like real excitement because yeah, it's I still play. That's I guess another thing. Like I'm not super into video games, but like I'll still play like Nintendo. Like I'll get the Nintendo system. I'll play Mario. I'll play the games I played when I was a
The
kid.
OG. Is it the system?
No. I have like the just throughout the years owning the six the successive Nintendo systems and playing like Mario, the latest version of Mario or Zelda, because like I still like can get into those and still get that that excitement from it.
That is the show. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Nick, for doing the show. If you want to see photo documentation of Nick's memory, we found it. We found the moment of him opening up that Nintendo, and you can go to the Instagram. This is your afterlife to see it. it's a fun little, another little compliment to the episode. Thank you to This Is Your Afterlife house band Lake Mary for all the music. Go to patreon.com/DaveMarr to become a patron and tell a friend who enjoys lighthearted conversations about death about the show. If you listen in Apple Podcasts, review it or email me. This is your afterlife podcast at gmail.com because I love getting feedback and talking to people about these things. So that could be you. And until next week, remember, you are a mist.